This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to our latest episode of the Latin American Studies channel. I'm your host, Mini Soni, and I'm a professor of Hispanic Studies at the University of Delhi in India. Today, we're going to be talking about a book by Adrian Schubert titled The Sword of Luchana, Baldomero Espartero and the Making of Modern Spain, 1793 to 1879, published by the University of Toronto Press in 2021. Adrian Schubert is a professor of history at York University and a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada. He has published the following books: Death and Money in the Afternoon, A History of the Spanish Bullfight, The Road to Revolution in Spain, The Coal Miners of Asturias, A Social History of Modern Spain. He's been awarded the Guggenheim Fellowship for the Humanities. So, Professor Schubert, thank you so much for coming and talking to us today.
Oh, it's a great pleasure, Minnie.
The first question that I want to ask you is that you have said that Baldomero Espartero, who lived from 1793 to 1879, led a life resembling that of a character created by Stendhal or Gabriel Garcia Marquez. What prompted you to write a biography on Spain's first modern public figure, of whom a postage stamp was released in May 2020, and who you compared to Napoleon and Garibaldi? How have biographies become a kind of micro-history? Because you've written at length elsewhere as well on this topic.
Okay. Well, that's a great question to start with. So writing a book about Espartero is something I had in my mind for a very long time before I actually started. In fact, the idea probably began when I took a History of Spain course with Professor William Callahan as an undergraduate at the University of Toronto. At that time, he was this tremendously, I suppose, romantic figure. And it's a life story. I said it was truly amazing. Something is, you know, only I think the greatest kind of novelist, like the two you've mentioned, could invent, and also only the kind of life that would be possible at a moment of tremendous upheaval, such as, you know, the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars that came out of them. So let me briefly describe Espartero's life. I think he's a person who is not known outside of Spain and really not that well remembered today. So he was born, as you mentioned, in 1793. He was born in a small town called Granatula de Calatrava, which is in the very center of Spain. He was born into very humble circumstances. His father was a kind of carriage maker and wheelwright by profession. They had some land. So they weren't the poorest, but they weren't elites. And he was the youngest of nine children. And he was sent to study well, he studied with a local priest, and then he was sent to study at the University of Almagro, which was maybe about 20 kilometers away, where one of his elder brothers, who was a monk, taught. And he got it. He graduated with a degree, and then, as you know, Napoleon invaded Spain in 1808, and when Espartero finished his degree in 1809, he volunteered for the army to fight against Napoleon. And because of the changes that were taking place, he was able to attend officer school and become an officer. Something the new government, sort of the resistance government of Spain, did was open up the officer corps to anyone on the basis of merit, whereas before, it had, under the Ancien regime, it had been a monopoly of the nobility. So Espartero spends 3 years doing that. Then he graduates as a junior lieutenant, fights in some not significant action during Napoleonic War, the War of Independence, as it's called in Spain. So then that war ends, and the king, who had been basically imprisoned by Napoleon, Ferdinand VII, returns. And one of the first things he decides to do is to send a new army to the colonies in America to try and defeat the independence movements led by Simón Bolívar, José de San Martín, and others. And Espartero actually volunteers for this, which was somewhat unusual. A lot of officers tried to get out of it. So he volunteers. He ends up spending close to 10 years in America, fighting mostly in what's today Peru. A little bit of his time initially was in what's today Venezuela, and then subsequently in Argentina. He rises from a sort of lieutenant to brigadier general over the course of this time on the basis of incredible battlefield valor, for the most part, and developing the right patrons. So those wars end in defeat, of course. Espartero comes back to Spain. Like so many officers, during the fights in America, had expressed liberal political ideas defending the Spanish Constitution. When he came back to Spain in 1824, 1825, he found the country in the middle of what's known as the ominous decade, with Ferdinand VII engaging in widespread repression of anything liberal. Espartero is lucky to pass through the political purge that allows him to remain in the army. And he as a brigadier general, has a certain level of command. And in 1833, we find him on the island of Mallorca commanding a regiment. In the meantime, in 1827, he'd gotten married. And we'll come to that later, because this is one of the key points in the book. So in 1833, he's in Mallorca, and the Carlist War breaks out. And this is a civil war which will last for 7 years. And Espartero manages to rise even higher, becomes the commander-in-chief of the liberal armies, and subsequently the victorious general in the war. In the meantime, he's gotten involved in politics on the side of the progressive liberals. Spanish liberals at this time were divided into two large families rather than parties, the progressives and the moderates. And in the sort of political upheaval, there was the monarch was an infant, Isabel II, her mother, the widow of Ferdinand VII, was the regent and effectively head of state. In all of this political upheaval, Espartero emerges. Well, he's appointed to the cabinet. And then in 1841, he emerges as prime minister and eventually as the regent. There's a revolution which basically forces the queen regent to leave the country, abandon her post. And Espartero is elected. He's head of state. But he's not a very good politician. And in 1843, he's deposed by a military coup, a conservative reactionary military coup, goes into exile in England, where he's received as a great hero of liberalism. And he spends 5 years there. He's eventually allowed to come back. And he goes right away up to the city of Logroño, which is where his wife is from. And they're living there more or less quietly until 1854, when a revolution breaks out. And it looks like the Queen Isabella II is in danger of being overthrown. And she calls on Espartero. She writes him a short letter, about three lines on very basic paper, no letterhead, nothing. And basically saying, please come save my throne. And he comes down to Madrid. He's received as this tremendous hero. He's described as the personification of liberty. And he becomes prime minister again. But again, he's overthrown after 2 years, goes back up to Logroño where, in 1856, where he remains the rest of his life. He literally never sets foot out of there for 23 years. But in an odd turn of fate, even though his time as head of government in 1854, 1856 had ended very badly, and we can talk about this in more detail if you want, he remains an important political figure, particularly in the minds of many Spaniards. So that in 1868, there's yet another revolution. And this time, Queen Isabella II is overthrown and she goes into exile. And Spain now finds itself having to choose a new monarch. And there's this huge campaign to make Espartero king. And in fact, the provisional government, the head of the provisional government, writes to him and effectively offers him the throne. And he says no. And then that's 1871. And then he dies 8 years later. I mean, this, what a story from, poor kid from the middle of nowhere who ends up being offered the throne and turns it down, fights Napoleon, fights Bolivar, wins the Civil War. I mean, I think you can certainly understand why it would be attractive as a subject to write about. Anyway, this remained in the back of my mind while I did my graduate work at the University of Warwick at the Center for the Study of Social History, and then at the University of London. And it remained there even though my interests were in social history. And you mentioned the two books, two of the books I've written, which were very much social history books. But I, this idea was there, and I was always building up a bibliography and keeping track of any primary sources I came across. And then in 2002, I agreed to take a job as the associate vice president of my university. It was a new position for international relations. And it was supposed to be 3 years. I spent seven doing it, and it sort of turned out to be a sort of a break in my development as a historian. But during that time, I decided, okay, I'm going to give this a try. And the key thing was that I was able to track down Espartero's personal papers, which no one had ever cited. And I decided that without those, really, I couldn't do anything useful. So when I did track them down, and here I owe tremendous debt of thanks to not Espartero's direct successor, but the inheritor of one of his titles, the Duke of Victory, and the now late Duke of Victory and his son, the current one, who were tremendously generous in letting me see these papers. Thousands of letters, both those he wrote and, more importantly, as it turned out, I think those he received. When I finished my term as associate vice president, I threw myself into this project, and it led to a Spanish edition of the book, which was published in 2018, and then the English one, which is a slightly shorter version that we're discussing now, was published in 2021. So that's a very long way to answer your first question. The comparison you mentioned to Napoleon and Garibaldi, there are differences, of course. Espartero was really only a national figure, a Spanish figure, whereas Garibaldi and, of course, Napoleon had much, were European figures and even international, so global ones. The parallel has to do with the immense popularity that Espartero developed, what I call the cult of Espartero. And it was here that, you know, him becoming a public figure in a modern sense, that the parallel to Garibaldi and Napoleon comes in, and I think puts them in a category which is unique for 19th century Europe. There weren't, in, I would contend, any other similar figures. Now, finally, biography is microhistory. So biography, of course, is a much, much older genre than microhistory. Microhistory emerges in the 1970s, especially in Italy, and especially in the context of early modern European history, 16th, 17th century history primarily. And it's associated with people like Carlo Ginzburg, Giovanni Levi, Natalie Zeman Davis, and two of my colleagues at York, Tom Cohen and Elizabeth Cohen. And all of these people who practice microhistory focus on essentially obscure individuals like Minocchio the Miller, who is the subject of, you know, the first great classic of the genre, Ginsberg's The Cheese and the Worms, or a specific event like the Sentimental Murder, which is at the center of a interesting microhistory by British historian John Brewer. And the story in this genre, the story of an individual life, and particularly the individual life of an obscure person, both illuminates the past and allows historians to reach a wider audience, because these are, when it's well done, these are tremendously engaging stories. And microhistory has also contributed to what's been called the biographical turn in history and more broadly in the social sciences. Now, my own approach isn't microhistorical. Espartero is what would be called a great man, and great men, and to the extent they existed, great women, really not the subjects of microhistory. Rather, I put myself in the genre of what the French historian Sabine Lauriga has called biographical history. And this is biography, but biography which is guided by substantial historical questions. And I've been inspired by a book on Garibaldi by Lucy Ryle, and especially by Spanish historian Isabel Burdiel and her biography of Isabel II. And these are books, Ryle's on Garibaldi and Burdiel's on Isabel II, about great people, as is mine, but they also interrogate the idea of greatness. They ask what, and more fundamentally, who makes a person great? So they don't take greatness for granted. How is greatness constructed? Now, in my book, I engage with three substantial historical questions. And for each of these, I try to establish a protagonist in the book. So the first of these is political culture and national identity. And the extent to which there was a shared national identity in Spain and where it came from have been probably the major question in the historiography of 19th century Spain. And here, my protagonist is what Isabel Burdiel, in a wonderful phrase, called el coro de voces, the chorus of voices that created competing stories about people at the time. So there were many, many thousands of people, ordinary Spaniards all over the country, who admired, even revered Espartero. They saw him as the unyielding champion of liberty, and especially the bringer of peace after what was a very brutal 7-year civil war. In fact, the Carlist War was, in per capita terms, was more lethal than the Spanish Civil War of the 20th century. And it was people, these ordinary people, and many of them wrote to Espartero and told him how they felt about him. And this was one of the greatest sources I had for writing my book. It was these people and entrepreneurs who catered to them by producing lithographs, cheap books and other objects, affordable objects that people could buy, and they did buy. And this is the process that kept this cult of Espartero alive across decades and generations. It was something you can see in these sources that was passed down from parents to children, that people would write about, you know, when I was a child, I remember my parents talking to me about the great General Espartero and how he brought peace to Spain. And ever since then, I have been an Esparterista. I have been an admirer and supporter of yours. And in this way, Espartero became Spain's first political celebrity and first real public figure, and as well as the incarnation of public morality, because he had a powerful reputation as a very upright and honest person at a time when public life in Spain was racked by scandals about morality and honesty. And he became this chorus of voices, comprised of all these individuals, almost none of whom's name have made it into the historical record. They are the protagonists, and I've made a point about trying to name them in my book whenever I could. And they were mostly men, but there were a lot of women here too, which is important. And that leads on to the second question I try to deal with, which is gender. So across the Atlantic world, the age of revolutions, beginning with the American Revolution and leading through the French Revolution and the events it triggered in Europe in the first decades of the 19th century. The construction of liberal and republican political systems and new societies was accompanied by the need to define gender, what gender roles would be like in these new states, these new political systems and new social systems. And this is, for historians, this has been a longstanding question, particularly in the context of United States, British, and French history. But it's also been true in the context of Spanish history as well. And in recent years, there's been a substantial and sophisticated literature that has painted a much more nuanced and textured and complex picture of the creation of the liberal state in the first half of the 19th century in Spain. So initially, there was this idea, the idea that liberal states and liberal polities were dominated by the idea of the two spheres, the separate spheres. The public sphere was for men, the private sphere was for women. There was an absolute boundary between them. In Spain, this was known as the Ángel del Hogar, the Angel of the Hearth, after the title of a massive bestseller from 1859. But the more recent literature is showing that rather than this, and rather than there being something so clear set in place at the beginning of this process of revolution and political and social construction, that the roles of women were highly debated, and that women themselves participated in these debates. And women were a constitutive part of the liberal revolutions of the time. And interestingly enough, certainly in the Spanish context, these debates were not just between liberals and reactionaries or absolutists. The two families of liberals, the progressives and the moderates, also had fundamentally different ideas about the place of women in the new order. And the years between 1837, when progressive constitution was put in place, and the fall of Espartero's regency in 1843, a period in which the progressives were in power for pretty much all the time, was crucial in the creation of what Monica Burguera has called a respectable public femininity, which was centered on education and philanthropy. Although as I mentioned, in subsequent, in the second half of the 19th century, this gave way to a more classical separate spheres situation. So this is the second question I engage with. And here the protagonist is Espartero's wife, Maria Jacinta Guadalupe Martinez de Sicilia y Santa Cruz. And we can talk more about her if you'd like. She is a key figure in the book. And then the third question I engage with is historical memory. And this is, in Spain today, a hugely important and contentious question, historical memory. Although it is dominated, if not monopolized, by the Spanish Civil War of the 20th century and the Franco regime of 1939 to 1975 that came out of it. Now, it's not surprising in a country with such a tumultuous political history, which had two lengthy and lethal civil wars in a century, and in which a brutal dictatorship contaminated the symbols of nationalism, that that cultures of memory are particularly complex. And historical memory in Spain remains long, but fragmented and conflictual. And this is particularly where potential national heroes are concerned. So while the 19th century in general, and Espartero in particular, are not major topics of historical memory debate today, they are still debated to a certain extent. And this is a question which really does not have a protagonist in my book, which I think is also indicative of the situation in Spain regarding historical memory.
Now, you devote a considerable amount of space in your book to Espartero's wife, Jacinta, and you call them a power couple. And your view is that her role in his life and public life brought to the fore gender issues in the 19th century, which were a constitutive part of the liberal revolution, and the roles of women were the focus of debates in which women participated. Now, you've given us quite a comprehensive account of the motivations that led you to write this book and about Espartero himself. So now we go on to this topic, which is of considerable interest for contemporary readers. Tell us more about Jacinta.
Okay. Yes, I gave her as much attention as I could, and I've already explained that I use her as the protagonist for my discussion of gender. But Jacinta is a fascinating person in her own right. And if I could have, I would have written a double biography. Unfortunately, the sources didn't lend themselves to that. So I described Espartero's life, or Baldomero's life. And when I write about Jacinta, it's usually in the context of her husband. And that's the time in the book where I refer to Espartero by his first name. So Baldomero and Jacinta, not to put them on an equal footing. So Jacinta was born in the small provincial capital of Logroño, she was orphaned very young. Her mother died when she was infant. Her father died when she was three, and she was raised by her maternal grandparents, her maternal grandfather was a very rich, self-made man and politically a liberal. Now, in 1827, when she is 16 and he is 34, she marries Espartero, and they remain married for 51 years until she dies. And it seems this must have been an arranged marriage. He was stationed at this time, not in Logroño, but not far away. It's not clear how they met. The financial documentation around the marriage is there. She had a very substantial dowry because on her mother's side, she came from this rich merchant family. On her father's side, she came from the local aristocracy. And so she inherited a lot of land, a lot of property, not a lot of money. Espartero somehow, and I haven't been able to figure out how, had managed to amass quite a large fortune while he was in America. Because he certainly didn't have any money when he started out in life. And it's not clear how he made this. There's a legend about that he made it gambling, playing cards. But I personally find that hard to believe. In any case, they marry. He's twice her age. He's had this amazing life, you know, fighting against Napoleon, being 10 years in the American colonies fighting. She's a 16-year-old young woman, been raised in a small provincial town. It's sort of trying to wonder what they have in common. So Espartero manages to arrange for Jacinta during the Carlist War to be named a lady of honor to the royal court, to the Queen Regent. So here she is, a very young woman, reputedly a very beautiful woman as well, goes to court and spends a lot of time in proximity of the Queen Regent, the child queen, and the court nobility. And here she becomes involved in important political events. There's a wonderful letter where Espartero says to her, to Jacinta, "I'm not writing to the Queen Regent much anymore because I've got you. You are," and he says, "a living letter." So she's the back channel. He's having her communicate to the Queen Regent. And this is the point in which he's getting involved in politics. So she's playing a crucial role. Then she becomes the consort of the head of state. When he becomes regent, she's living in this palace in Madrid, presiding over all kinds of functions. In this time, she becomes a back channel between Espartero and the British government. He writes to her and says, "Tell this to the British ambassador." And this is stuff he's not even telling his government. So again, he's using her in an important way in these very, political matters of the highest level. She then has to go into exile with him. Just before they come back from exile, they have dinner with Queen Victoria. And in her diaries, Queen Victoria writes about this, and she describes Jacinta as a woman, very attractive woman who would have been beautiful when she was young. I mean, she was in her mid 30s at this time. So anyway, they come back. She spends a lot of her time as curating Espartero's public reputation, and then she's a very religious woman. He wasn't religious, She suddenly, in 1878, when she's 65, 66, has a stroke and dies very quickly thereafter. She's a lot, he's much older than he lives for another year. And I imagine him wandering lost around this big house they have in Logroño, Casa Palacio, it was called, without his beloved wife of 51 years. And the correspondence between them during the Carlist Wars, he wrote her, there are in his archives just over 600 letters he wrote to her while he's off on campaign. And he writes on horseback, he writes in the middle of the night when he gets back, he writes twice a day sometimes. Unfortunately, her letters to him don't exist, although reading his letters is a bit like listening to one end of a telephone conversation. You get a sense of what the person you can't hear is saying from what the person you can hear is replying. So she has this tremendous life as well. She was a woman of strong opinions, and she voiced them bluntly. In these letters, at least in Espartero replying to her, letters, it was quite clear that frequently she was telling him what she thought, and she told him when she thought he was wrong. And and again, on matters of politics. She was very forthright, and in some of a few of the letters of her that did survive, but written to someone else, she could be very forthright in describing Espartero's enemies. And interestingly enough, and she would often do so in English. So she clearly learned a fair amount of English when she was in exile, and actually subscribed to the Illustrated London News when she was back in Spain. Two of my most exciting archival moments in writing this book, probably the two most after getting access to Espartero's papers itself, have to do with Jacinta. The first was going through Espartero's correspondence and finding mixed in with his letters for the 1860s, 20 letters of hers that she was writing to the man who married their adopted daughter. They didn't have any children of their own. And she's writing on one of the big political controversies of the day involving Espartero. And then the other one took place when I was at the University of Southampton in Great Britain, looking through the Palmerston papers, Lord Palmerston. And there was a lot of correspondence between Palmerston, who was foreign secretary at the time, and a British ambassador in Madrid. And this covered the period when Espartero was in exile. And there was a crisis involving the Queen, as there very frequently was. And Palmerston writes to the ambassador, you know, we've got to get Espartero back there, but we especially have to get Espartero's wife back there to help deal with the Queen. She's an exceptional woman. And I thought, you know, I'd almost sort of yell. So here's, you know, one of the most powerful men in the world, you know, talking about how wonderful Jacinta was. So that, you know, that was just one of those historian's moments.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
That's a wonderful exposition you've given us. Right. Now, we talk about the next part where you talk about historical memory. Now, you contend that though historical memory might be a burning question, but in Spain, it is centered almost exclusively on the Civil War and the Franco regime. Soon after the Spanish publication of your book, when you wrote, and I quote, "The most famous and revered Spaniard of his time, the person many saw as the embodiment of peace and constitutional government, has been completely forgotten. He has never, ever been accorded the modest recognition of a postage stamp, end of quote. And then apparently the post office issued a postage stamp of him within 18 months, citing your book. And elsewhere in your book, you quote Karl Marx, who wrote in a New York Tribune article that Espartero was one of those traditional men whom the people are wont to take upon their backs at moments of social crises, and whom, like the ill-natured old fellow that obstinately clasped his legs about the neck of Sinbad the sailor, they afterward find it difficult to get rid of. Why did Espartero fall into oblivion?
Yeah, I was really pleased with the postage stamp, especially, as you said, the official announcement from the Spanish post office cited my book. And I guess that counts as a kind of public policy impact sort of thing our universities want us to do these days. Well, let me start with the quote by Karl Marx. I mean, it's pejorative, but it's not, that's not surprising. And it was part of Marx's analysis of the Revolution of 1854, which he wrote for the New York Herald, for which he was a frequent correspondent in those days. And the Revolution of 1854 can be seen as a sort of belated Spanish version of the revolutions of 1848. Spain was one of the few places in Europe that did not have a revolution in 1848, mostly because the Spanish government really clamped down on things and didn't allow it to happen. But a revolution did happen 6 years later. It began as a military movement, but then took on a popular aspect, and the goal of which was to overthrow an increasingly authoritarian government. But it also, for a certain period of time, looked like it was going to overthrow the monarchy itself, Queen Isabella II. And this is the context that I mentioned earlier. She writes to Espartero, who is up in Logroño, and says, please come to Madrid, become prime minister, save my throne, basically. And he comes to Madrid, although first of all, he sends one of his aides down to negotiate terms. But he comes to Madrid, and there's this tremendous, tremendous outpouring of joy. The descriptions are just mind-blowing. And he's received, amongst other things, as the personification of liberty. This is what they're calling him. And I think that Marx, and not just Marx, did not and could not understand the popularity, this kind of popularity, because Espartero had been the victorious commanding general in the Carlist War. He had been sort of baptized by ordinary Spaniards as El Pacificador, the bringer of peace. And Spaniards, both on the liberal side of the Carlist War and the Carlist side of the Carlist War, and also, as well as the bringer of peace, the kind of defender of liberty. So there was this incredible popular cult, you know, affection, even reverence for Espartero. And this explains this tremendous reception in 1854, which Marx is, you know, dismissing. But, you know, I guess we can't blame him for that. But it really just doesn't come close to understanding the nature of Espartero's relationship with many ordinary Spaniards. Now, in a sense, Marx was right, because Espartero would end up gravely disappointing all the hopes that were put on him in 1854. But we, you know, if you want, we can go into that later. But your question is really about why did he fall into oblivion? Now, he died in 1879, but he did remain sort of in memory, at least for the rest of the 19th century, and was invoked widely in the press at certain moments. So a number of official statues or monuments were erected to him. One actually was a tomb. He and Jacinta had both been buried in a cemetery in Logroño, but a decade after his death, so in 1889, they reinterred the two of them in the Cathedral of Logroño in a tomb that was paid for by the Spanish state. And it's interesting that, as far as I know, this is the only monument, official Spanish public monument, to a public figure and his wife. So it's the great General Espartero and his wife, Jacinta. It's really quite impressive. When their remains were transferred in 1889, it did trigger a lot of discussion in the Spanish press, reassessments of Espartero's career, but in light of what was going on in Spain at that moment. And when the statue in Madrid was erected in 1895, there were similar discussions. But that's really the end of it. By the beginning of the 20th century, Spain has entered into the age of mass politics, and Espartero now falls basically into total oblivion. He's really no longer relevant in this new political context. During the Civil War of the 20th century, there are some references to Espartero, and particularly to the way he ended the Carlist War, which was an act of reconciliation between the two sides, very theatrical, very 19th century, where he and the Carlist commanding general embrace each other on horseback in front of the troops of both armies that they've stationed around them. And this embrace of Vergara, as it's called, is the subject of some discussion during the Civil War on both sides. And it's interesting enough, it's denounced by both sides. In fact, at the very beginning of the war, Emilio Mola, who is the man who organized the military revolt that began the Civil War, in one of his first speeches says, "We're not going to have any embraces of Vergara, nothing but absolute victory." And this kind of line gets repeated on the Francoist side, but it also gets repeated on the Republican side. So, you know, since Espartero and, you know, what for his life, you know, in his life was the most important thing he did, and the thing that people most valued, is being rejected out of hand by both sides in this 20th century civil war. Now, it's not in the current context, it's not surprising that the more recent past, the Spanish Civil War and the Franco regime, dominate public debate on historical memory, especially in a country where there are hundreds of mass graves that remain unexcavated, and the remains of many thousands of people who were murdered remain unidentified. And this is, you know, this is a human tragedy, and is and should be at the front of public debate. But the sort of Espartero falling into oblivion is, I think, the symptom of something larger, and that is the inability of Spaniards to figure out what to do with their 19th century and with its long liberal tradition, and how, or even whether, to try and make this into some kind of usable past, to incorporate it into their public discourse. And they really, it's never been done. I mean, the 19th century, for a long time, the dominant narrative of Spain's 19th century was failure. One of the most important books written in the 1970s was called The Failure of the Industrial Revolution in Spain. And the idea that the 19th century was a disaster. The country couldn't industrialize. It couldn't sustain normal political life. It was just one military coup after another, et cetera, et cetera. The Franco regime made its own contribution to this, because for Franco personally, for example, the 19th century was a disaster, but not for the same. For him, he said in one of his speeches that he wanted to eradicate it from the memory, from Spain's history, because it was the century where everything went wrong, where, you know, and I guess to put it into more contemporary parlance, Franco wanted to make Spain great again, and it was the 19th century that had led to it ceasing to be great. And so 40 years of denigration of what Francoists like to call the false outmoded liberalism and other things of the sort did their work as well. So the 19th century as a whole, the 19th century liberal tradition, which was a long one, and Espartero as a person, have not found a place. Now, it is interesting that all that said, Espartero has not been totally forgotten even today. And where his memory is most alive, although in a negative sense, is in Catalonia. And it has to do with the ongoing issue of Catalonia's relationship to the rest of Spain and whether or not it will become independent. Now, the reason for this is that while Espartero was regent, there was an uprising in Barcelona. And Espartero went from Madrid to Barcelona and personally ordered and oversaw the bombarding of the city. Now, in the context of 19th century Spain, bombarding a city was not unusual. There were numerous other contexts where in the context of revolts, government officials bombarded a city. But Catalan nationalists and Catalan independentistas, or separatists, depending on your point of view, have seized on this. So, and it turns up in the media every once in a while. Back in 2016, I was interviewed on Catalan television, and the very first question was, is it true that Espartero said that it was necessary to bombard Barcelona every 50 years? Well, the answer to the question is no, he never said it. But this is something that somehow has gotten, you know, some kind of urban legend that he allegedly said this, and this is what many people in Catalonia remember. Now, it's interesting that even after bombarding the city, Espartero remained hugely popular in Catalonia for decades. In fact, I would say he was probably more popular in Catalonia than many other parts of the country. But just the other day, just last week, as a matter of fact, the city government of Barcelona, as part of a larger project, changed the name of one of the streets in the old core of the city, the Gothic quarter of Barcelona, to remove the last vestige of Espartero from the city street plan. So in 1857, they had named one of the streets down there the Duke of Victory Street, again, referring to his title. In 2008, the then city government changed it to Duke Street. So, you know, they're kind of removing Espartero from the equation. But now, just last week, it was decided even that was too much. So they've changed the Duke Street is no longer there, and the street has been named after a woman by the name of Josefa Villaret, who led a bread riot in 1879. So it's interesting who gets the street name, but in our context, what's interesting is that even today, there, you know, for some people, Espartero has to be removed from the equation.
So thank you very much, Professor Schubert, for talking to us today about this book. You've actually brought Espartero back to life, you know, for all of us. And I'd like to thank you. And I hope this book also becomes a textbook for university students all over the world. Mm-hmm. So thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and thank you for your wonderful questions.